Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to today's segment of Afternoon Satsang, where both of us, Brother Prem and myself, will be continuing a gripping portion from the book Conversations with Sai, Conversations with Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba, written by Dr. John Hislop, wherein he has captured some very interesting, intimate and insightful interactions with Bhagwan at various places. Though we used to have a fortnight of conversations followed by a fortnight of a general topic, the last few sessions we saw Swami's in-depth focus on the mind, its vagaries, how to control it, how to focus, you know, bringing in God, the difference between the formless and the form God. It is so beautiful and comprehensive that we didn't have the heart to disconnect it, and that is the reason we are continuing it for this fortnight also. We have not yet decided whether we will be continuing the same in the next fortnight. It will all depend on how much we cover today. So there is a lot waiting here, and even as both of us go through it, it's been a very thought-provoking, insightful and inspiring inspiring progress for each of us. So we hope that we'll be able to communicate the same. And as always, before we begin, we offer our most humble and loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, praying to him that may his light shine through our thoughts and words so that all of us can benefit in this beautiful global satsang that Bhagwan has made it possible. So let us begin by welcoming Brother Prem as well. Sairam Prem.
Sairam Arvind, and Sairam to all our listeners, and thanks to all those who sent feedback about this program, especially this discussion which is happening. And as we've seen, it's a very deep discussion born out of much learning from Dr. Hislop himself. As somebody would say, whenever they give a commentary on the Upanishads, compared to the Puranas, the Upanishads are all about direct questions. Like some Upanishads will start with a question of who sees through my eye. Right? Mm-hmm. That's a question that you would ask after you've gone through a lot of thinking. Somebody who is not given a thought to spiritual matters will not probably ask a question like that. And I think we can see that, we've been mentioning this a couple of times in the last couple of weeks. Hislop's questions are very, very deep. But in a way, Swami is making it so simple and so practically applicable, which is something which happens, when Swami is in his presence, Swami is amidst us. The physical presence or the ability to relate to God in this manner makes the whole thing so much more easier. And that's one thing which Swami is repeatedly mentioning over the past few discussions. Now, Swami is saying it all comes down to love. When you do it with love, it is fine. And when there is love in the mind, then automatically the mind will be in the right path. And all of those things Swami has been mentioning. But at the same time, the discussion is also of a different level. We could see that some visitors in between asking a few questions seem a little off the line when compared to what Hislop and Swami are discussing. So we're very happy that we had this opportunity to go through this with all of you, dear listeners, and hopefully at least something percolates inside as we go through it, and hopefully some understanding comes for us too.
If I remember right, the last time where we stopped was when Hislop asked Swami, having heard everything that Swami is expounding, he says, Swami, therefore everything comes from within alone. There's nothing that comes from outside. And Swami replies by saying that there is one exception. And that one thing that comes into man from the outside, that thing is the ego, which is formed by attachment to outside objects. With desire for the world cut, ego automatically vanishes. Impressions that are taken into man from outside, if taken as the reality, are harmful. Because man looks at something outside and then creates, he thinks he is reproducing the outside. Whereas, in fact, the outside thing seen merely recalls to memory that which is already within. Now, this is what we were discussing, and it would be apt to begin our discussion today also with the same thing. It will be a good continuity and a good refresher as well. This is a very, very powerful and impactful point Swami is making, that we are thinking that the outside world is influencing what is within us, whereas Swami says the truth is what is inside is influencing the outside world. He says that the outside thing is merely recalling to memory that which is already within. This makes much more sense when we realize that what is already within also includes our Purvajanma samskaras. One may wonder that how is it that a baby perceives things then, because it's just born. But then I remember another beautiful analogy example that Swami would give of a cloth that is bought and kept in the cupboard for many years, and then you stitch a shirt with that cloth, a brand new shirt, and then when you wear it, it tears. And you wonder, how is it that the new cloth, that the new dress that I'm stitching is tearing, why is it so flimsy? Swami says it is new as a shirt, but as a cloth it has existed in your cupboard for so long. And I think in that context, Swami was explaining about the karmas, about why, you know, people die very young or as children when there is not much karma that is created. So Swami was reminding everyone there that karma is not only about actions done in this life, it is across so many lives. A baby you think is very young, it is not as young as you are thinking. Only the body is young, the soul, the jivi is, you know, as ancient can be. So also when Swami says that how we perceive things, what we see outside is nothing but what is inside recalling to memory, which is already within. So this we have to remember that it is spanning several janmas. And that is the reason, though you take twins born to the same mother, in the same family, growing up in the same environment, yet we will see them exhibiting very, very different characteristics. In fact, in the Indian movies, formerly this was one very favorite theme, to show how one member of the twins becomes the villain, one member of the twin becomes the hero. In fact, to show that all their strength, focus, energy is just the same because they're twins, yet one is directed in an evil manner, one in a good manner. And I think inspiration for the movie themes come from real life. And when we see this in real life, it becomes very clear that it's not just about genetics or the family upbringing or the environment in which you come up, though they have a bearing on you. There's a huge bearing that comes from impressions of past lives or Purvajanma samskaras, as we call them.
Right, and this is, and again, this is something which is so practical, you know, when you look at it. There's one example that I had read sometime back where the spiritual master was giving this example of, you know, somebody sitting in an airport.
Hmm.
And that's a time, that's a place where we all tend to spend a lot of time, especially, you know, you have to, they tell us to come 2 hours early, but it's always means that you have to sit there for much longer and you don't need so much time in an airport anyway. So invariably, or when you're in transit, you'll be sitting there for 2-3 hours. So you would say that imagine that you're sitting there in an airport and you're just seeing, you have nothing else to do. You're just looking at the scene there. Right? And, this person is saying that you can see endlessly that scene for a long time, till you see somebody who looks familiar. Because the moment you see somebody who is familiar, then your mind actually jumps into it and says that, hey, it's this person, or then, you know, that's a chain of thought which starts.
Hmm.
Or you see a scene which triggers your some thinking. So it is always something that is already inside you, which connects with what you're seeing outside. So what Swami is saying here, that, you know, whatever you see is actually a recall from memory of what you've already seen or what you've already gone through. And if you look at it, that's what everything, you know, whatever learning that we have, the example of, you know, you're walking on the road and you see a vehicle coming towards you. Why is it that even before probably the vehicle hits you, there is that fear which kicks in, there is the adrenaline which starts rushing? All of that is because you connected with something which can happen, which is already there in your thinking, which you've already thought of, which you've already seen, or which you anticipate at a point. So there is that a connection between that inner world and the outer world that Swami will speak of. In fact, I still recall, I don't know whether this really happened, but I know you were also there in one of the summer courses when suddenly one of the elders told Swami, you should speak about the 5 akashas.
Oh, yes.
The 3 akashas.
Yes, that was in the Ramesh Hall, if
in
I remember
Ramesh
well.
Hall, right.
Yes.
So, yeah, of course, what we were told was Swami would have wanted to speak on that, and Swami would have told that elder to, you know, request
start
Swami,
the topic.
Right. So that is actually one of the topics which Swami is talking about here, though without mentioning it. Swami would say the Bhutakasha and the Chittakasha.
Hmm.
There is an outer universe and there is an inner universe in your mind. And all your interactions or the fears or the emotions that you have with the outside universe is because the inner universe is interacting with the outer universe. Mm. And that's why in deep sleep, there is no interaction and there is no fear, there is no emotion, all of that. So that idea of whatever you see is, I mean, it's a very, very empowering thought that Swami is saying, that the key to all your anxiety is actually within you, not outside.
That is really empowering. And Swami has even narrated a popular story from the Mahabharata to highlight this. I think we also enacted this as part of a convocation drama in Bhagavan's presence, and Swami would watch the scene with keen interest, wherein Lord Krishna calls two, one the eldest Pandava brother, Yudhishthira, and the eldest Kaurava brother, Duryodhana, and sends them on two separate tasks. Duryodhana is tasked with going around the entire kingdom and finding one good person, absolutely good person who exists in the kingdom. And then Yudhishthira is called and given the task of going about the entire kingdom and finding one absolutely bad person. And then Swami says that both of them return with their findings. It's very interesting. Yudhishthira comes to Krishna and tells, Lord, I searched everywhere in the kingdom. Trust me, I couldn't find even one absolutely bad person in the kingdom. Everyone has some good in them. If at all I have to find an absolutely bad person, possibly only I come close to it. Otherwise, I don't think anybody is bad. This is what is Yudhishthira's answer. Duryodhana's answer is along similar lines. He comes and tells, oh Lord, I searched through the entire kingdom, but I couldn't find even one person who is absolutely good. And he says, if at all there's anybody who is absolutely good, I think it has to be me. That's it. And then Swami would say, it was the same kingdom. The same kingdom that Yudhishthira and Duryodhana went to. While one found it filled with only absolutely good people, the other found it filled with absolutely bad people. And then Swami would conclude by saying, there's nothing wrong in the srishti or creation. It all lies in your drishti or vision. And that is what is being said here as well. That, you know, it is not the outside that is changing the inside. It is the inside that is determining what is outside. You know, so many such paradigm shifting techniques Swami has taught us, and it really, as you rightly put it, it empowers us. In fact, another thing along similar lines I remember is what Swami says in the Dharma Vahini. He says that, you know, people think that it is Kali Yuga Prabhavam, meaning it is the impact of the Kali age. It's an expression of helplessness to say that there is so much bad happening and I can do nothing, because what can I do? After all, it's Kali Yuga. But then Swami brings up the example saying, if you look at Hiranyakashipu and Prahallada, they both lived in the same Yuga. While it was the best of times for Prahallada, it was the worst of times for Hiranyakashipu. And there Swami says, remember, it is not the Yuga that determines Dharma, but it is Dharma that determines the Yuga. I mean, if you are leading a dharmic life, it becomes the golden age for you. And if you are not, it becomes the worst time for you. It is not as if there is a specific time when dharma is bad and specific time when dharma is good. Depending, it is not time determining dharma, but dharma determining time. I mean, that's such a paradigm shifting statement for us to digest. Similar is this, so empowering and paradigm shifting, when Swami says that it's not the outside that's influencing what is within, it is what is within you that's influencing what you perceive as the world.
You know, that's the beauty of the concept which Swami is talking about. Often they would give this example of, you know, when you talk about Vedanta, it's a very abstract topic. You know, here what we're talking of is probably a parallel to that is what we speak of in quantum mechanics as the observer effect. You know, when the observer contorts the observed.
Correct.
And where they say that without this this contortion, you can never have a reading, because as long as the observer exists, there is going to be a little bit of distortion.
It's a paradox, because without the observer,
there is no observer.
You can't get an observation. And the very introduction of the observer brings in a...
Right. So it's similar to that. And they would say that, you know, these are all concepts that are very fundamental. You can, it's like a thought experiment, or it's like pure mathematics, which will not find any direct relevance. But the same concept, when it is taken into the Puranas, right, or the stories like Mahabharata, Ramayana, that's where you get the stories like the Chinnakatha which Swami narrates of Yudhishthira and Duryodhana. The concept is the same, but when it is put in a story, it becomes much, much more practical in daily living. That, you know, I can have a peaceful mind and my day will be peaceful, or I can think good things and then good things will happen to me. These are all real experiences also, but comes from a very, very fundamental Vedantic principle where Swami is saying that, you know, the idea that it is not directly logical in that sense. It's like saying it's like an ostrich response to danger. The ostrich puts its head inside the ground and thinks that the danger has vanished. It stops seeing the danger. That's all. The danger is still coming at it. So here Swami is saying that when you stop seeing, the world ceases to exist, which is not practically something which we kind of experience in everyday life. Because I close my eyes, the world vanishes for a minute, and then when I open my eyes, it's again there, which means it was always there. It's just that I've turned myself away from it. But fundamentally speaking, without the observer's presence, there is no observation at all. And in fact, some of the scientific experiments they're trying to do now, you know, basically, I think when you look at chemistry, one of the most important things that we experimentally have to do is find the temperature of the solution at different points in time, something like that. So they find the moment you introduce a thermometer, the surface temperature of the thermometer starts interfering with the temperature of the solution. So they've come up with ways by which, you know, the system itself acts as a thermometer. Can you put a thermometer in the container itself, or in the stirrer itself, or in a tube which is running through the solution or something like that? So in other words, you're trying to make the observer part of the observed to get as close as possible to the observation. But the truth still remains that as long as there is an entity which is an observer, there is no observation which is perfect. So in a way, whatever we see, the universe, the way we see it, it's because we see it. The universe which when not seen is completely different from the universe that we see. Right? And I think that's the point which Swami is saying that, and he's referring to the, when Swami says I, it is not only about seeing, it is all about, you know, the cognition of the whole thing, your senses and everything. And Swami is saying it's not the I, but it is the three guna I, which is the ahankara, which Swami is saying. So which means as long as you are an individual, there exists a universe which probably does not exist the moment the eye vanishes or the eye closes.
And that is what Swami says. He says, when the eyes are open, one sees creation. All beings are created by the help of the eyes. The source of all that you see is the eyes. All so seen is impermanent. The three letters in eye represent the three gunas. But with eye, that is the letter I, the self, one can see something quite beyond the transient. It's so beautiful that Swami plays with the number of letters in each of the eyes. He's saying the I, E-Y, E-I has a three gunas, a sattva, rajas and tamas. And that is why all this, whatever we see, the creation, the srishti, everything comes about. But the moment we are able to identify with the single I, and this single I is beyond the gunas, it is beyond, and therefore it is that state which we spoke about where there is no observer. There is no observer or the observation. That is how, you know, Swami would say that example Swami is going to tell right after this, where in spiritual mathematics, Swami says 3 minus 1 is 1.
Right.
I think rather than we tell it, we'll continue with the reading and then discuss that. Because as Swami says this, Hislop asks, would Swami please explain his statement that the world is a mirror? And Swami says, the world is a mirror and life is the reflection of God in that mirror. If the mirror is pure, only God is seen. The opposites, good and bad, are no longer seen at all. There is only God. If the world is not seen, in other words, if the mirror is removed, then there is neither mirror nor any reflection. We have the idea of the world only because of the mirror effect. So, you know, this is how 3 minus 1 becomes 1, because Swami says when you stand in front of the mirror, you are there, the mirror is there, the reflection is there. You remove either yourself or the mirror, then only one remains. You know, the reflection goes off. If you are gone also, the reflection goes off. If the mirror goes also, the reflection goes off. So Swami is saying here that the world is a mirror and life that we see is the reflection. But it is a reflection of what? It is a reflection of God, because God is being reflected. That is what Swami says. But we are not able to perceive that because either the because the either the reflection is contorted or it is not there because of impurities in the mirror. And I think we had either in the satsang or somewhere discussed about the three kinds of impurities also,
right,
which is dust on the mirror or a vibrating mirror or a completely covered mirror. That was
Viksha, Mala and Avarna.
Mala, Vikshepa and Avarna, the three kinds of the three kinds of defects that prevent us from seeing a pure reflection. So Swami says that is how it is. That is the analogy of the mirror. So whatever idea of the world we have today is because of the mirror effect. Remove the world, then the reflection is gone. Or if we are able to see the reflection as myself, then the mirror doesn't have any negative effect. Now what's happening is, I'm not able to perceive the reflection as divine. In the sense, I don't perceive everyone else as divine. That's why I have all the kama, krodha, lobha, moha, all of that comes in. And that is why the world is able to play havoc with me. But once I'm firmly rooted in the conviction that the reflection is nothing but the divine, then whether the mirror is straight or whether it's crooked or it's bulging, it's convex or concave, it won't matter because I'll know. I mean, that's what it is. Like, if I see myself in a convex mirror, I will look so fat. I would never like to see myself fat like that. So fat. Extremely obese. But then, when I look at myself in the mirror, I don't begin to hate myself because I know that that is not the reality. The knowledge that whether I look fat or distorted or contorted, because there are many mobile apps also now that come, you know, where you can mirror image of picture and distort it and contort it in various ways. But it doesn't bring in a disgust in me because I know that irrespective of how it is me only. So once that knowledge is there that the reflection is divine, then the mirror stops having a negative impact on me. That is what it is, that it's all about what is within. The world will stop having its negative impact on me when within there is that deep conviction of the truth.
You know, just talking about how the, you know, the programming of the mind when you see the mirror reminded me of something which we often come across in when we're studying about cameras, when you study about one of the subjects that is taught about in when you're talking about digital cameras is how the mind sees and how the eye works. Right. And one of the things which we have come across even in science is actually what the eye sees is an inverted image of what is in front of you. Right. That's how the optics goes. That what you see is a smaller form and an inverted image which goes and falls into the optic nerve. And then the scene which is in front of us is actually the processing that the mind does.
Hmm.
That it straightens the image and it gives the idea of depth. It gives the idea of color and all of that. Actually, we don't realize how much the mind does for us to be able to see what we are seeing. And one of the things when we were studying about those cameras and we were seeing that video, suppose you were to walk with a camera, right? You would find that jerk, which is so obvious when you later film that scene of you walking with a camera and then you see it.
Mm.
In spite of all the optical stabilizations that you can do, you will find that a little bit of jerk and it's disturbing. So they go on to say, actually the same is happening when we are walking and when we are seeing around.
Hmm.
But the mind is so good at that stabilization and it does it so fast that it doesn't make us even feel that it is happening.
Yeah, that it is jerking.
Huh? It is jerking. So it's an inbuilt process by which the mind sets right all the aberrations which the eye can actually, you know, give you in the form of the observation that it makes. So it's almost like that where you mature your mind to such an extent that even when you see this reflection, constantly it's like the reprogramming that you've done, that whatever you're seeing is part of yourself, or whatever you're seeing is God, as Swami would say, and Swami is saying here. So that becomes so spontaneous that you never move away from that idea that this is part of me, that you'll never get into any of those, as we have mentioned many times before, kama, krodha, moha, mada, matsarya, all of that is born out of duality.
Mm.
And all the good qualities Swami mentions is actually born out of the idea of non-duality. So there is no scope for duality at all, and there is no scope for any of the other thoughts to step in. And I think that's what spirituality is all about. We are trying to tune ourselves to constantly remind ourselves that this is nothing but a mirror. We are not seeing it another person. This is the same person. I think recently I had given a talk in which the talk was such that it was about others' opinion and what others think of us. So one person came and told me, but why are you going on talking about others? Because Swami says there is no other. There's no, right? it's because that's something which Swami has always told us, that there is no other person. And when you get that drilled into your mind, the way you think, the way you respond will be completely different. Mm. I think that's the programming spirituality is all about.
Absolutely. And that also enhances and, you know, reaffirms what Swami said, that what we see outside is what has happened within, what is within us. Because, you know, we don't realize how much the mind is actually doing our seeing or our hearing. You know, for that matter, when you're sleeping in a peaceful room, a small cat mewing or a dog bark at a distance is enough to wake you up. To overcome that, you know, when we had gone to a hill resort, we had this problem with our baby. Baby is not able to sleep because of these sudden random noises that would come. It is so silent that suddenly a dog barks at a distance, she gets up and starts crying. You won't believe how we overcame it. We overcame it by putting on an app called White Noise. You know, it, what is this White Noise app? It creates a noise. We sell, for example, you select a gurgling stream. It's like a stream flowing by and it creates quite a decibel sound. And you know, in that, the baby is able to sleep comfortably. Basically, what's happening is the decibel level of the sound of the gurgling stream from the phone is louder than the bark of the dog or the mew of the cat. But then it's a constant sound. So, even in the infant's brain, in the infant's mind, it is able to calculate it and take that, you know, subtract this, this is silence. You know, the silence here is, say, 3 decibels. 3 decibels is a silence, therefore, 3 decibels you won't hear. So, though there's a constant sound going on. So, when it is 0 decibels, a 1 decibel sound will cause disturbance to you. But when 3 decibels is constantly there, the mind itself subtracts that. You know, so that you are deaf to anything below 3 decibels. That is how the, you know, mind functions in all our senses, whether it is listening or seeing. In fact, all that we see as audio illusions or optical illusions is exploiting this capability of the mind to learn and fill in, you know. That's how you create optical illusions. That is what man has done, you know. He has thought further on and tried to fool this aspect of the mind. So also it is, like you said, so it fills in. So much of our learning, so much of our seeing or hearing in daily life also, as you said, spiritually, if we can train it in that manner, so that just like with a white noise device you become deaf to any sounds at that decibel, so also if, you know, I can create that spiritual white noise so that I am deaf and blind to anything that is lower, and I only visualize something that is higher, I think that's the way we'll be able to become like Yudhishthira and see only good in the world and no bad at all.
Right. And of course, the one more analogy which Swami has already spoken about is that of, you know, sleeping and dreaming. Because when Swami says that when you close your eyes, the world vanishes, the universe vanishes, it might not, as we're saying, it's not a practical experience that we have in everyday life. But when you say that when you wake up, the dream vanishes, that is something that we can relate to. But when in the dream, it all looks so real. We are in a city, and there are hundreds of people, and they don't vanish gradually. They vanish one shot. You know, however big the dream is, or however massive the scene is in the dream, or it might be filled with a million people. But Swami says, when you wake up, everything vanishes in one second. Right? So Swami would give that also as an example of how the universe vanishes along with your ego. When you wake up from the idea that you are this individual, you find that the whole universe vanishes because it was nothing but a projection of this ego itself.
You know, we'll just continue reading, because I think we have overlapped some of the discussions having read all this. Swami continues to say that the mirror world exists only as long as our desires exist. World means the inside sense world. We apprehend the world through the senses. These senses are seen outside. It's only because of the illusion of the senses that there appears to be a body. A corpse is burned when the wood is set afire. The inner senses correspond to the wood. When they are burned through inquiry and sadhana, the body automatically disappears. Both inquiry and practice are necessary. So, Swami highlights the importance of practice of sadhana, as well as this constant inquiry. I mean, we should be restless to find out this answer. Because unless we find this answer, we will be restless always in life. In fact, that is the reason most of us turn to spirituality as well, because we are in the quest of happiness and peace, and irrespective of what we do, what we gather in terms of our wealth, riches, power, influence and experiences, that happiness and peace seem so elusive, and that's why we turn to spirituality hoping to gain happiness and peace. And it all looks like such a beautifully designed system where unless you search for the right thing, unless you ask for the right question, you will constantly be restless. I read about this in the book Autobiography of a Yogi, wherein Sri Yukteswar Giri, the guru of Paramahamsa Yogananda, tells him that this dissatisfaction has been built in. So that till you embark on the right search, you will constantly be kept dissatisfied. No problem. If you say, I don't care about God, spirituality, I am going to go and pursue wealth, go ahead. Because at the end of it, you will find dissatisfaction. You will not be at peace. You will be at peace only when you find peace. And as Swami would say, happiness is union with God. Only in God you will get that happiness. So till then, no problem, you are free. Because as the saying goes, however far the bird may fly, it has to come back to the tree to rest. That is how it is. That is why the masters sometimes appear very lenient and give you freedom. Tell, yes, go ahead, do that. Go, yes, do that. In fact, if we see Swami also, that's what I used to feel, you know, at times. Swami knows what is the ultimate and what is the pursuit we should be in. But if we go to him and tell, Swami, this is my plan, I want to do this, I want to set up an industry, chalam manchidi bangaru, do it. No, he'll encourage. And you know, sometimes you think, Swami, what are you doing? Are you pushing him towards ruin? It is not. Maybe I will tell that, no, I have set up an industry, I am an industrialist, listen to my experience, it is not going to give you peace, don't go that way. I think Swami prods you to go ahead because finally it is a personal experience. How much ever others may tell, I may think that it didn't work out for you, man. When I am an industrialist, it will work out for me. That's why Swami says, you know, in different ways, we say that is our previous janma desires or samskaras, whatever, it has to be burned down. Swami says, yes, go ahead. And when you come back and tell, Swami, it's such a headache, I don't want it. Swami will tell, yes, correct, Bangor, he'll encourage you. Because it is a process where you have to go in to try to fill up that dissatisfaction, and we'll finally come to the point where we realize that there's only one way to fill up the dissatisfaction. And then when we get on to that, that is when I think Swami fully takes us and encourages us. That's why Swami says here that the inner senses correspond to the wood. When they are burned through inquiry and sadhana, the body automatically disappears, and both inquiry and sadhana for this are absolutely essential.
And very true. What you're saying about, you know, the cravings have to be followed by us and given up. In fact, I think that is what the four purusharthas are all about. You know, dharma, artha, kama and moksha. The most beautiful thing about Sanatana Dharma, which Swami would say, is it never tells you don't go after, you know, prosperity, don't go after wealth and comfort. It says that do pursue it if you want, but pursue it through a dharmic path so that you don't get entangled in it. And in the process, you will also find out that it's meaningless. You'll find out that it's a mirage. Only when you walk up to the mirage, and if you walk up to five mirages and then you realize that there's no water there, the next time when you see it from a kilometer away, you'll know there's no water there. Right? You only learn it from experience, as you said. But you have to ensure that in the process, you don't do such karma that you get entangled in that. So at some point, you will find out that, you know, these are all meaningless. And that's why I was reading about the difference between the animal brain and the human brain. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they say is what we refer to as the prefrontal cortex, the part which is right behind our forehead. Mm. And usually they say that that's the part which, the bulging part in the front, is what is different from most mammalian brains. And these are all very rudimentary studies, but they realize that most of the discrimination happens in the front part. Mm. So if you look at what Swami says, you know, you have a buddhi, and you can use that buddhi for worldly discrimination or spiritual discrimination. As long as you're so obsessed with how can I make more money, how can I find more comfort, how can I become more successful, Swami says the same buddhi which is so precious, which can actually open the door towards the higher levels of existence, you're using the same buddhi for something which is enhancing nothing but animal life. You know, an animal can find itself a good habitat, you're finding a better habitat for yourself. Animal can find good food, you're finding tastier food for yourself using the same buddhi.
You know, when you say this, I'm reminded of a question that I asked one of my cousins. You know, when I was small, he was a big fan of the tennis player Andre Agassi.
Okay.
So, when he was talking about Andre Agassi, he was himself a tennis player, mm-hmm. my cousin.
Okay.
So he was playing at the district level, and I asked him, I asked him, will Andre Agassi be allowed to play this tournament? You know, he's an international star.
Right.
Will he be allowed to play the disc? Because I said, you know, if Andre Agassi plays, he'll just win all these, right?
Mm.
Like in the international level, he may win, may not win.
Mm.
But if he comes here, it'll be victory, victory, victory. My brother said, he will be allowed. But why on earth will he be foolish to come and participate here?
Right.
That's such a thing that today now I understand, maybe it's prize money.
Mm.
But if
mm.
we take it spiritually also, means this talent, whatever, the brain, what you say, the mind that is given, yes, it can achieve. But why would you want to choose a lower level achievement
right.
over a higher level?
And the beautiful thing is that prefrontal cortex, I mean, the way they study these mapping of the brain usually is, you know, they give you a certain kind of questions you're asked to think about, especially discriminative questions.
Hmm.
You're given a moral dilemma, you're given a situational analysis,
hmm.
and they'll say which part of the brain gets triggered when you're thinking of those things.
Hmm.
So they find that it's always the prefrontal cortex.
Hmm.
And they also find that when you start asking yourself existential questions, like who am I, where did I come from, what is the purpose of life, they find that it's the same prefrontal cortex which gets activated. So which means it's the same discrimination. You don't have a separate discrimination for spirituality and separate one for the world.
Which also means that it also makes us realize why Swami says, Jantu naam narajanma durlabham.
Right, exactly.
Possibly because animals can never ask this existential question.
Animals can never ask these questions, and animals can never, as very beautifully in one of the discourses Swami says, animals can never willfully give up a worldly life. He say animals, you know, some animals have the sacrifice built into them. Because it's part of their give and take with other species or in the ecosystem around them.
Mm.
But only man can willfully say that I don't want this, I'll go for something higher. Or say I don't want the higher, I'll stick with this.
Both it gets clear when you see, you know, there is this craze among a few people to have exotic pets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they keep a python, they keep a gorilla, they keep... And, you know, they shower it with all the love like a parent does for a child. And yet there are many cases of this pet growing up to harm the
mm-hmm.
owner. I mean, that shows, you know, what you just now said, that animals don't have that capacity. You know, how much ever you may love me, I'm a tiger, I'm going to lunge at prey. I'm a python, I'm going to swallow you up. That's going to happen because they don't have the ability to willfully say that, no, I will give up this. I know I would love to eat, but I will give it up because I love you.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, they were I was seeing this TV show where they were showing how they befriend wild animals, like the big cats and all that. You know, you see these videos where they start coming and hugging and all of that.
Mm.
It's nothing but playing with their mind.
They're called animal whisperers.
Right. You know, the animal only sees two kinds of individuals, right? One is a prey. The other is a competitor for territory. Right. If you're not either of this, you become an ally.
Hmm.
So when human beings interact with these big cats, it seems this is the thing they establish. They establish that we are not your prey. You cannot eat us by showing that they're superior, by probably having a whip or having some something which can give them a light shock to tell them that we are in control. And the other is that we are not here to harm you, or we are not interested in taking away what is yours.
Maybe so, they feed them.
Right. And once you establish this, the relationship they have with you is what is left, which is that of a comrade, which is that of a friend. So it's not that the animal chooses to befriend you, or, you know, it sees that, okay, you're a friend. It's all programmed into the animal. But when it comes to human beings, and that's why Swami says this precious buddhi or discrimination which you have, you are getting it caught up in all this worldly, you know, is this car better or is that car better? Or should I buy this or should I buy that? You're using that precious buddhi, which is so specific to human birth, in something which is so animal in nature, the decisions which are so animal in nature. And that's why when Swami says that, you know, that inquiry, it's almost like that spark in that wood. Once you start the inquiry, you kind of, everything looks in a different color to you. Everything looks in the way it is supposed to appear to you.
On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break, and on the other side of the break, continue this gripping conversation.
know the world is a mirror from head to foot. In every atom there are 100 blazing suns. All things of the universe are links of a single chain. Shake but a flower and a star will shiver in turn. Life and death are one, even as the river and the sea are one. In the depths of your hopes and desires lies your secret knowledge of the beyond. Let me bathe my soul in colors. Let me swallow the sunset.
Mirrors of
rivers flowing east and west merge in the sea and become one with it. So do all cultures lose their separateness when they merge at last into the pure being. When they merge at last into the pure being.
Welcome back, dear listeners, and we are in the middle of a very riveting discussion here, which started with Hislop asking some very, very fundamental, important questions, where one of the things was, would Swami please explain his statement that the world is a mirror? And I think that's what we were talking about. What Swami says that a wonderful statement that Swami made, a corpse is burned when wood is set on fire. The inner senses corresponds to the wood when they are burned through inquiry and sadhana. And the body automatically disappears. Both inquiry and practice are necessary. So this is the point we were discussing before we went into that break, where even as we go through life, this inquiry and the sense of wonder as to what is life and what is the purpose of life is something which will come. And there's one story which I always go back to. There is this man, a businessman who goes to a master and asks him, you know, what is the purpose of all of this? Because, you know, in business, you always have ups and downs and profits and losses. Mm-hmm. He says, sometimes I make a lot of money, I'm very happy. Sometimes there's a loss. Sometimes my children make me happy. Sometimes they put me through hell. And he says, what is the purpose of all of this? Mm-hmm. And the master says, this is the purpose.
Says, to make you wonder about what the purpose.
Says, what do you mean, this is the purpose? He says, so that one day you will come and ask the question, what is the point of all this? Right? Because especially if you've led a good life, you know, if you've been a crooked person, I think you'll just try to become more crooked. Mm. Or if you're on the verge of being crooked, you'll probably say that, you know, the world is not a place for good people, let me try evil ways. Mm. But if you've been a very, very genuinely good person, if you've been a dharmic person, you've done everything the right way, you know, you've had your heart at the right place, when things don't happen as they're supposed to, you'll automatically wonder that, you know, I'm missing something here. And in fact, that's what even Krishna tells Arjuna, that, you know, when you've done good karma for a long period of time, you will automatically transition towards karma yoga. You'll automatically wonder that, you know, I'm missing out something. There's something different I need to do. And that is where that Viveka and Vairagya will step in. And Swami says the Mumukshatvam also will come along with it.
You know, what you said just triggered in me something that I used to think about. It might be a slight deviation, but it's nevertheless relevant. This question as to why is that the good suffer and the bad don't seem to suffer. In my own primitive way the explanation came to me was that when we look at the good and bad, the good always seem to be on a mission to transform the bad, you know. And we see that to different varying extents in each one of us. But on the other hand, the bad are, you know, what we consider as bad, are comfortable with the good. In the sense, if you take a robber, for instance, the robber doesn't want everybody to become robbers. Because it is the good men or good people on whom he can prey upon and rob. So I feel, when you see the good and bad, the good are always trying to change the bad, whereas the bad have no intention of changing the good. They are fine with the good being there. They depend on the good to be there. And because the dual world is ordained to be good and bad, never can the good completely transform the bad. It is never going to happen. Which means that the good in its effort is bound to get frustrated sometime and then try to find a solution on how to transform the bad. And finally the solution that will come is Advaita. Which is, you can't change bad to good. You have to go to the level of Advaita where you realize that everything is just part of a drama. And I think that is the reason why Swami also encourages the good. That is why possibly bad keeps happening to good, because as you said, that is what prods you to go ahead. In the beginning, it appears to be the problem. It appears to be the pain. But it is that pain and problem that actually makes you ask the right questions to find the ultimate answer.
Right. And I think that is the that is also the importance of, you know, what Swami would say is satkarma. That even though that good and bad is equal, or good and bad is not there, and it's a non-dual word, Swami would say that why good actions are more important, because it's the good actions which prepares your mind. Swami would say that the more good that you do, as Swami quotes, I think it's the original is that of Chanakya, where he says, Kuru Punyam Aho Ratram Smaranitya Nityatam, and the third point, four things. He says, Tejad Durjana Samsargam,
Tejad Durjana Samsargam, Bhaja Sadhu Samagamam, Kuru Punya Mahoratram, Smaranitya Nityatam.
So Swami would say that that's the four-step practical way to a spiritual life. Give up bad company, go look for good company, constantly do good actions morning and day, and in the back of all this, in your mind, constantly inquire what is true and what is false, what is eternal and what is transient. So Swami would say that that's all is spirituality. That's all it takes. So that doing good actions is so important, because that's a means by which the mind itself gets prepared for the higher task. And in fact, Swami would speak about that. You know, the four, the Shat Sampatis, as they call them, not the Shat Sampatis, the four truths or the four paths that lead you to the divine. One among them is Shat Sampatis. Swami would say Viveka, Vairagya, Shat Sampatis, and then Mumukshatvam. The Shat Sampati is nothing but goodness. It's all about be good, don't hurt another person, do your duty, and you know, don't be too greedy, don't be too jealous. That's all is Shat Sampati. So Swami would say that Shat Sampati is there, automatically Viveka and Vairagya will come, and when all these three are there, that craving for moksha will automatically start blossoming in your heart.
Going ahead with the discussion between Hislop and Swami, Hislop says, you know, when Swami speaks about the mirror or the world existing only as long as the desires exist, Hislop says, but Swami, our experience is that objects exist independent of our consciousness of them. Very apt and interesting question, because whether I'm there or not, the chair, the table, the bottle exists.
Exactly. Just the point which we were discussing. Me closing my eye does not make the scene in front of my eyes vanish.
Vanish. And Swami says, for us, the world exists only if we are there to see it. It's not if I'm able to see it, but if I'm there to see it.
Right.
If we are blind, we do not see it. If we are in a faint, it does not exist for us. For us, the world is as we see it. It takes shape for us according to our viewpoint. And I think, Prem, we discussed this, saying how Yudhishthira saw it, everything as good, and Duryodhana saw everything as bad. Right. Though it is the same thing. So that's what Swami is saying. It takes shape for us according to our viewpoint. If your viewpoint is that all is God, then everything we see is God. Suppose we take a picture with a camera. Do the trees enter the lens and impress themselves on the film? Or does the camera reach out and grasp the trees? And Hislop says, the trees impress themselves on the camera. And Swami says, wrong. I take a picture of a person who does not want his picture taken. Will the refusal prevent the picture? Or put it in another way, the person wants his picture taken. Will it result in the picture? The heart is like a film that can capture the image of Swami. If the film is latent and clean, it can capture Swami even if he does not want it. You're the photographer. Even if Swami doesn't want you to take his photograph, if you choose to click, it captures. But if the camera is without such a film, if the heart is impure and clouded, then Swami's image cannot be there even if he wants it. You know, having taken Swami's photographs for some time, at least on 2-3 occasions, you know, I remember while clicking a picture, Swami would, after I've clicked the picture, Swami would ask, film unda, reel unda, he would ask, is there film in the camera? And I would think of it as just an opportunity that Swami is giving for interaction. Because come on, Swami, none of us are so silly that we'll click a button without having the film inside. But on those two occasions when Swami had asked, both those occasions, when I said, Swami, I have film, Swami asked, do you have extra film? I said, no, Swami, it's in the camera, but extra I don't have. And both those occasions, Swami ensured a mass distribution of films, you know. All the students who have cameras were asked to raise their hands, and from inside Swami's interview room, film rolls came. Just continuing the same thing on another occasion, you know, this was the time when digital cameras had come into being.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami asked me, film unda? I said, no, Swami, there's no film. But before I could go ahead, Swami made it a joke in front of everyone and said, see, this fellow, without film, he's trying to take photos. Immediately, I ejected the CS card from the camera and said, Swami, there is a chip inside. And then Swami, you know, acted like, oh, yeah, means as if some, it's a technological advancement that he's unaware of. He said, oh, something, it is okay, fine, he has. But, you know, at that moment, when we think that it is such a natural thing, Swami, who will take a photo without a chip or a film? Swami is saying, that is how it is. Even if God is present, if you don't have a chip or film, you can't get that image imprinted. And Swami goes on to say that, you know, he so beautifully says, he says, the body is the camera. The mind is the lens, because we need it to focus. The intelligence is a switch. It's not enough if you have a body and if you have a mind which can focus. You need that intelligence, discriminatory switch to press it. And love is the film. There needs to be love. Then Swami gets captured. And so beautifully, you know, I don't think we need to explain anything. We just need to revel in what Swami has said. Because Swami says, if you have love, if you have the discrimination, if you have the mind that is focusing on God, and the body is fit and taken care of, then even if God doesn't want, he gets captured. But if any of this is missing, then even if God wants, you won't get that image imprinted. That is why, you know, Narajanma Durlabham, the body, the human body is so valuable, because it's the camera. The mind, that's why Swami says, you know, Karanam Bandha Mokshayo. Manaeva Manushyanam Karanam Bandha Mokshayo. The mind is responsible for both, because it's the lens. It chooses where it can, it chooses where it can focus. And then the intelligence, it is so important, buddhi, because it should decide to capture. And finally, the basis, the undercurrent of everything, you need love. Because even all the other things are functioning, if that love is not there, nothing is captured. You know, I remember once Sai Prakash saying how an important interview in this very studio was being recorded. Professor G.V. was conducting the interview. And at the end of it, they realized that they had forgotten to press the record button.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he says that it is the greatness of G.V. sir, that when we went and told him that, sir, you know what, the whole interview we have not recorded. He said, okay, what's done is done. What can be done about it? Let it go. At least we have the audio. That's the greatness and wonderful nature of Professor G.V. sir. But it shows, right? See, so even if you have love for God, even if you have a mind that can focus, and if you have the human body, but if you don't have the discrimination to choose Swami constantly above others, then also it doesn't get. All these four need to function in collaboration together at the same time, simultaneously, so that we get Swami. And when this happens, as Swami says, it doesn't depend on Swami's will. You need not say that Swami is not willed. No, whether Swami wills or not, you will become a bhakta.
I think a lot of things Swami is putting together, in fact, whatever we had discussed so far. One thing is Swami is saying that it's all in the viewpoint. The most fundamental thing is Swami saying that if you do not exist, the universe ceases to exist for you. Then from there, Swami takes to the thing of what is the emotion with which you view decides how the world looks to you. And, you know, we gave the example of Yudhishthira and Duryodhana. And a step higher than that is when you want to capture Swami. Like when the scene in front of you is that of Swami, the person in front of you is that of Swami. We've seen this. There are hundreds of thousands of people who come for Swami's darshan. Swami would say this. And there's a crowd, even pickpockets come there. Not all are devotees. But there will be a lot of people who come as devotees, a lot of people who come as people who are just curious, people who have come to drop off others, people who have come to accompany others. But not all of them see the same side, not all of them internalize the same image. There's a beautiful episode which Mrs. Jayalakshmi Gopinath would narrate, Jayama Madam.
Mm.
You know, one of her first trips to Swami in the early 40s. Right? She came as a very small girl. She was a school girl. And she always used to enjoy decorating the altar of the old mandir. So apparently it was the last day they were leaving that afternoon or something. And she was decorating the altar and she went behind the curtain and she started doing some cleaning or something. And that's when Swami came and called her parents for an interview, because Swami knew that they were leaving. So these, the parents came and they were looking for her. They could not find her, so they went away for the interview. And she comes out and she realizes that Swami has called them for an interview and she missed out. And she could not stop her tears. And, you know, till the evening, till they were leaving, she was going on crying. So at one point, Swami comes out and, you know, Swami, she's sitting at the altar and crying, and Swami comes there. And Swami starts consoling her. Swami says, no problem, don't cry. And then Swami asks her, what do you want? And it's those early days, you know, you don't have any photographs of Swami. She looked at Swami and said, Swami, give me a picture of yours. And then Swami so beautifully tells her, why do you want a picture? See, if I give you a picture, if a fire comes, it'll get burnt. Mm. If rain comes, it'll get wet. If you crumple it, it'll get spoiled. Swami said, capture me in your heart. Then you can take me forever with you. You know, she says that that was the first message she got from Swami, and, you know, that's a message for a lifetime. And that's what Swami is saying here. And if you want to capture him in your heart, as Swami is saying, where there is love, you will capture. If you have something to do with that, if you have an emotion with which you attach to that form, to that presence, then you will capture it in your heart. Otherwise, as Swami is saying here, it's the absence of that love is like the absence of the film. Without that film, the lens is there, the object is there in front of you, there is a trigger, you trigger it off, but it doesn't get captured. And so beautifully Swami has put all of those points, whatever we are discussing together, in this one analogy.
And really, Prem, if we take each of them in itself, we can discuss for so long. You know, I was just thinking of the mind as the lens. You know, my mind went to different, you have different kinds of lens, you know. You have a lens which is like, say, 24 mm to 200 mm.
Right.
Which means you can zoom. It is again another ability of the mind. So suppose, you know, I'm in a room and I see, say, Swami. Swami is sitting there. This would happen. Because not just in a room. I mean, generally that would be the condition that in the 1990s when I came to Swami, when Swami is seated, he's surrounded by so many. And yet I have got so many close-up pictures of Bhagwan. How? It's because using the lens, I have zoomed on to Swami. Which means, you know, that gave me a very strong message right now, that the mind is like the lens. If we choose to focus and zoom, then even if there are 100 things, there's a decoration, the paraphernalia, the people standing, good people, bad people, as you said, the seekers, the pickpockets, and Swami, the mind can be used in such a manner that you can focus only on Swami and get a lovely close-up image of Swami. I mean, that's why I said each of that. Whether
even as you're saying this, one of the what we refer to a prime lens, just like how you have a zoom lens, you have a prime lens. And the reason why people fancy a prime lens is because of that bouquet effect that you can get, where the foreground is extremely clear and the background becomes, you know, milky blurring effect that you can get. I recall a beautiful picture which one of my classmates once shared. It was that of a lovely bouquet or something like that, and, you know, it was a beautiful picture, very colorful and all that. The next picture was of the same scene, but the flowers were all blurred, and in the foreground were Swami's feet, right? And he just captioned it like, it depends on where you focus is what you see. And many, many times, you know, whenever whether it is in the ashram or in your life or in your work, when you find difficult people you work with or difficult situations come, I always go back to that picture. It's like, what do you focus on? Swami is there in this place. If you want to focus on Swami, everything else blurs out. But the moment you lose focus in Swami, everything else becomes clear. You start seeing all the nonsense which is there around. So as you're saying, it's when Swami says the mind is like the lens, so much depth is there in that. It's all about where you want to put that focal point and where you want to fix it.
You know, so much goes on. I think we'll take another little break and then continue with the same discussion.
से जीवन धन्य हुआ है साई तेरी कृपा से जीवन धन्य हुआ है साई
जब भी डोली नैया अपनी तुमने पार लगाई जब भी डोली नैया अपनी तुमने पार लगाई
से क्यों डरूं, तुम हो मेरा साहिल।
सहस्र कोटि सूर्य सा साई तेरा दर्श मिला,
जग की मृग तृष्णा
back, dear listeners. When we took the break, we were talking about a beautiful analogy that Swami gives about how the image is captured in the mind, and how Swami was giving the example of himself where he stands in front of you and he says the mind is like the camera, the love that you have for Swami is like the film and the intelligence is the switch. So as a follow-up question, Hislop asked Swami, he says, but Swami's image in the heart is his form. Krishna says the devotee need pictures. The devotee need picture the Paramatma as unpicturable. That is enough. What does that mean and how does it apply to the image of Swami in the heart? So that's the question he asked. Again, it's a question based on, I think, something that he has read before, which is what Krishna says in the Gita, I suppose, where he says that the form of the Lord, you finally reach that state where you worship the formless.
Picture the Paramatma as unpicturable.
Unpicturable. There's somebody who is beyond the form, beyond attributes. And it's a reference to that. And Swami's answer to that is, the image need not be that of Swami. It may be love, which is Swami. First, God is realized in form. he is seen everywhere in that form, then God may be realized without form, since all forms are impermanent. Swami goes on to say, a learning child sees an elephant statue. On the statue, the word elephant is written. The child cannot read the words, but learns about the elephant and from its name as it hears it. Once he has learned to read, then just the word remains, and from that he understands elephant. The statue, the form, is impermanent, but the words remain as long as the language endures. The word elephant represents elephant in its formless state. Likewise, once the devotee learns the language of divinity, meaning get the experience, then God need not be pictured. The word is enough. But one learns about God through form and the name. It's a beautiful example that Swami is giving, and I mean the question itself is pretty deep, where it is something. I mean, this is something which is up for much debate. Where there are some religions which always speak about God being formless, and which is true. Even Vedanta speaks about that. Even your Sanatana Dharma, all the Smritis also speak of God being attributeless. But a beautiful example that Swami is giving here, yes, that is the state, but you don't get there without this process. Or this is the process by which you get there. And again, it is a reference to something that we do every day. How did we learn when somebody tells an elephant? It's like, it's the famous game that is played. Don't think of a pink elephant. Right? Mm. And that's the only thing that comes to your mind. How is it that it comes to your mind? It's because that you've associated this word elephant with a certain form. You've associated the word pink with a certain color. And that is how it comes, even though it is not in front of you. And even though you're being told not to think of it, it comes to your mind. That's because of that association. And so sweetly and beautifully, Swami says, associate that love to a form and name. And there comes a time when that name itself is enough. It will create the images in your mind.
And so beautifully Swami says that after that, no? You can give up both the name and form. That's why it is these monotheistic religions, they consider only name is enough, no need of the form. But as you rightly said, it is so essential. And you know, I was also thinking, Prem, when you said pink elephant like that, because having a very small child at home teaching the child,
mm-hmm.
How does the child know it's an elephant? Because we have taught it, you know. Like if I had shown a cow and trained the child that that's the elephant, she would have seen the cow and called it an elephant. So, in that sense, the term is just a term that we are using indicatively. Mm-hmm. Swami would often give the example of the forefinger being used to point out to the moon. I can use the thumb, the little finger or the middle finger. They're just pointers. Once you see the moon, you don't need it. These are different analogies Swami gives to say that once you understand divinity, you don't need it. Again, it's not about the name or form. See, when we say, even after I learn reading, the child learns how to read, then E-L-E-P-H-A-N-T is enough to get the form in the child's mind. But again, you know, it is so different because I think both the name and form come because of the experience. Again, another experience as a father, you know, for my daughter, her favorite animal used to be the cow. She would love the cow and she used to make the sound of the cow till she came face to face with an actual cow, you know. I remember that we had gone on a drive and near the window a cow came. This was the first time she was seeing cow from so close quarters. Once she saw the cow, that's it. Cow is no longer her favorite animal. Currently her favorite animal, I think, is the rabbit. But what happened is, when without the experience, the name and form actually don't mean, you don't understand what it is. As for a child, a cow, an elephant, a rabbit, all are same because they're all equal sized in her book possibly.
Right.
So I also think even with God, it's like that. That's why Swami says it's so important that we learn, once you learn the language of divinity, once you learn it, then the name and form are enough to, and that experience we have to, and for that we have to yearn. We have to yearn and crave. In fact, we had discussed this sometime before also, where Swami has said, do you yearn for it? Do you ask me for it? If you ask, I'll give you. You ask me for so many things. Have you cried and said, Swami, I want an experience of you. I want to feel you. Please give me that. You ask that, I'll give you. We need to get that experience. Once we get the experience, now, yes, for my daughter, she doesn't know how to read, but the word cow, she knows what it means. If I just tell, shall I get a cow, she'll tell no. If I tell, shall I get a rabbit, she'll tell yes. Why? Because of that experience. She has experienced both the rabbit, which is there in our indoor stadium, and the cow, which is everywhere in the village. So once you get the experience, the name and form are able to. So till it's like we have to get the experience, and then yes, you can drop off the form, you can drop off even the name. The name and form are just used to bring on that experience. Like that Swami is saying here, it's about the love, to bring on that feeling of love. So therefore, just like Pavlov trained the dog, you know, to salivate every time a bell is rung, because it refers to food. It's not that the dog is yearning to eat a bell, but the dog is yearning for food. It has just got associated with that. In the same way, all of us are, you know, pipasi. We are thirsting for love. We all seek only love in our life. So associate that with the purest form and name available, which is that of divinity. And once you are able to trigger that love, then you can drop off the form, you can drop off the name as well.
And absolutely. I think that's the most beautiful explanation that Swami is giving. In fact, there was this, I forgot which movie is this, where it's about a child who is visually impaired as well as hearing impaired.
Helen Keller story, is it?
Yeah, I think it's a Helen Keller adaptation.
An Indian movie.
Right, Indian movie.
Called Black.
Yes. Yeah, that's the movie. So there is this teacher who is trying to teach this child to, you know, and one of the things that he says there is, see, for all of us, since we're able to see, since we're able to hear, we know that there is an object which has a certain form. And these alphabets which I put together, which is having a certain form, is related. Hmm. And when I read out these alphabets in the form of a word, there is a certain sound. So I know that I have to associate the sound with what I'm seeing here with the real form. Right? And when you say a child is not able to see and child is not able to hear, you have to get this idea into the child's thinking that there is something called a word. There's something called a name.
Hmm.
And it has a visual experience. It has a a hearing experience or an audio experience. So he says that is the challenge. Once you get that, and in the movie they very beautifully show that, that once the child gets that association, that there is a name for everything that she experiences, and then she starts going into the experience of learning more words and learning more names. If you look at us, it starts off very early, and it starts in an age where we are not able to, really savor that experience. It happens so quickly, and probably it happened so early in our life. But that's what happens. We associate always, as Swami is saying here, a name, a word, and the actual form, and an experience to that. And the same thing we're trying to replicate when it comes to God, when it comes to divinity.
And, you know, the time is almost running out. I'll just would like to conclude with another thing. If we go to the Sanskrit language, this is what is emphasized even with the terms. Swami says, the word, spoken word or language is called pada,
mm-hmm.
and the object is called padartha.
Right.
And Swami would say, padartha means that which brings, artha is meaning. Swami would say, that which brings meaning to that pada is padartha. So that's why the word rose or any flower's name is the pada. And object is padartha, meaning that which brings meaning to that word rose. Is the actual rose. So, this is no wonder Sanskrit is called the divine language, because even in the terms and even in the way the grammar is in everything, this divinity and spirituality is embedded. No wonder it's called Daivi Vak or Daivi Bhasha. So, that's how it is. As you rightly said, it's not just about God. Everything is a pada and padartha. We learn to associate the word, the sound, and the object. And later on in life, it becomes such that whether it's a sound or whether it's we are reading the word or we are seeing the object, all the three get triggered. And that is the same thing Swami is telling you have to do. Associate love, divine love. That is also so practical, I feel, because we experience different kinds of love. We experience romantic love, we experience fraternal love, we experience motherly love, fatherly love. But as Swami has said in many discourses, all of them have traces of selfishness in them. And that is why we build this concept of divine love, which is pure selfless love. And for that pure selfless love, we attach it to a name and form. We can't attach it to mother, father, friend, because it gets a meaning mix up. We need to create a new word to explain that. And that's what is happening if we see in English, even to this day. New words are being created because this is an experience which has a close enough meaning, but it doesn't have an exact word. So a new word gets created. In the same way, for this pure selfless love, we create something called God, and for that a name and a form. So that next time, you know, when I say motherly love, I know what motherly love is. When I say friendly love, I know what is friendly love. None of that. Divine love is something much higher. And that is why we associate with the name and form of God. And the idea is not about worshipping a name or a form. It's about being able to imbibe and experience that love on a constant basis. So just like we form word association with other things, we form this word and sound association with divine love.
And I think that's the beauty of this entire discussion. It is ranging from something which is so abstract and so esoteric, Vedantic knowledge, and something which is so applicable to us, be it in our relationship with Swami, and so beautifully Swami has given these analogies, as well as how we can improve ourselves on the spiritual path itself. And I think that's why this work is so very beautiful. And thank you, dear listeners, that it's in your company that we are getting the opportunity to go through this text in detail. We mostly humble offer this with our humble gratitude at Swami's lotus feet. We'll join you all again next week, 12:30. We'll now leave you with a beautiful song. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Chandu for the next segment of today's Thursday Life. Sai Ram.
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना साई मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना दर्शन के प्यासे अखिया तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले नयन कमल मन मोहक मादक रंजित है अधरारे तेरी छवि अति सुंदर केश ये है घुंघराले निराले इस छवि को हम मन में भर कर तेरे गुण को गाए तेरे गुण को गाए मन मेरो लागे
लागे ना तेरे बिना रे
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना
तेरे बिना जग माया काए बंधन टूट न पाए
तेरे बिना जग माया काए
बंधन टूट न पाए
जीवन नैया पग पग डोले जीवन मैया पग पग डोले
तू ही पार लगाए
तेरी शरण में लेके प्रभु तू कृपा शांति बरसाए
कृपा शांति बरसाए
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी अखियां
तेरे दर्शन की प्यासी
जीवन ज्योत जला साई मेरे
जीवन ज्योत जलाओ साई मेरे
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना रे
मन मेरो लागे ना तेरे बिना
यू आर लिसनिंग टू रेडियो साई थर्सडे लाइव स्टे ट्यून्ड